From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Election Day 2018. Voters from Rochester to Buffalo had a choice. Send Chris Collins back to Congress, even though just about everyone knew he was guilty of insider trading and would likely go to prison, or elect Democrat Nate McMurray, the Grand Island supervisor who had run an aggressive campaign in a typically red district. The final total was very close. Collins receiving 140,146 votes, McMurray receiving 139,059. That made Collins the winner by 0.3 percentage point, a total of just 1,087 votes. And as expected, his new term wouldn't last long. He resigned in September, was convicted, sentenced to 26 months in prison for doing what, again, just about everyone knew that he had done. It was just another in a line of scandals and embarrassments for Western New York members of Congress. McMurray has essentially never stopped campaigning. He will once again be on the ballot as a Democrat in this race in April, in the special election to come, in a district that often elects Republicans by wide margins. But he believes the district is turning. His opponent is Republican State Senator Chris Jacobs. And we expect to have Mr. Jacobs on the program very soon. We've been in touch with the campaign, and we look forward to that. But this hour, it's a chance to sit down once again with Nate McMurray and explore the issues that he thinks are determining voters' choices in this election. Running for Congress in the 27th, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for that very comprehensive and authoritative review of what's happened. It's kind of an incredible story if I hear it all at once.
Well, I think in many ways for you, as I think the Buffalo News recently said, you've never stopped running and you really believe you can win this time. So I have to start by asking you what I'm sure some voters have asked you, which is you were running against a guy that everybody knew was going to go to prison last time. Now he's in prison. You still didn't win. It was very close. Why do you think you can win this time?
Well, you're trying to find a race like that where we had almost 100,000 people cross over from their previous voting positions to vote for me where somebody lost. It just doesn't happen. So let's start with that. It was almost a miracle that we pulled it off in the first place with the enrollment advantage that the Republicans have. I knew it was the right thing to run, even though I knew it was a very difficult uphill battle. I knew that we had to give it our all because of Mr. Collins' history and record and how dangerous he had been and how neglectful he had been of the region. Now, why do we have a chance going forward? Well, number one, people know I was on the right side of history last time. And a lot of people were on the wrong side of history, including media figures in this same town that supported and told people, vote for Collins. Keep the seat red. Literally telling people, choose party over country. And I think people realized that that failed them. And they were also told that Chris Collins was innocent. Chris Collins himself said he was innocent. Even after he won the election, the Buffalo News did a poll. He still ranked as the most popular potential GOP candidate, even after the election, even after more additional information about his wrongdoing had come out. So I think you have a history here of people seeing that they've been lied to, not only by Mr. Collins, but by the establishment that supports him. They see that I have been dogged and aggressive consistently, and I've been right, and my judgment's been proved right. And I think I've had a lot of people cross over to support us. And with a special election, we have a chance to finally bring real representation to this seat.
April 28th is the special election. We're looking forward to meeting Chris Jacobs, who the state senator who's running against you. I've not met him, but I've been in touch with the campaign, and we're going to work that out very soon. How long have you known him?
For a few years. I don't really know him. I've had acquaintances with him in the past. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very different person than the first person I met. When I met him, he described himself to me as a moderate. He never said President Trump's name. He was beloved for being a moderate and someone that could be working on both sides of the aisle. In the last 6 to 7 months to win this nomination and the support of his party, he has gone very deep into the extremes. He is his campaign is basically saying blindly that he's going to support President Trump no matter what. And his record was really not that moderate in the first place. If you look back at what he did as a state senator, he voted against health care for all New Yorkers. He voted against LGBTQ plus rights. He voted against things like consumer protections and union rights. But now, with his fierce allegiance to President Trump, he wouldn't even say President Trump's name in the past. I think he's really born again into something that is much more terrible than he ever was.
Well, but it was just a few days ago that President Trump did formally endorse your opponent, Chris Jacobs. And Chris Jacobs on his website is touting that endorsement. Mm. I know you say that when you first met him, he wouldn't even say Trump's name. But now he's in a district where, look, Republicans in this country support Donald Trump very, very strongly. Voters support the president very strongly. Obviously elected leaders by a wide margin do. I mean, this is not sort of a pariah in a party. Isn't the president pretty popular in your district?
He may be, but we're talking about what's right versus what will get you to win. And I've been a politician from the get-go who did what was right and let the consequences follow. I knew that from the beginning, running against Chris Collins was difficult. I know it's difficult in this district to say that I oppose President Trump. But when you see the things that are happening in our country, like this morning, where you see the removal of a national security chief who said that that Russia is working to, again, interfere with our election for President Trump, removed and replaced with a former Fox News analyst. Now, this is chilling stuff, and if we don't talk about it, it normalizes it. And a man of such privilege and wealth as my opponent, who was opposed by his own party, many in his own party, to come out so strong for Trump, that also is chilling to me. And I'll say this as well. I think that his positions have changed so dramatically, so suddenly, that you people listening have to ask, what does he really believe? What does he represent? Even if you disagree with the things I say, you know that I truly believe what I'm saying, and I'm sincere, and I won't be bought or sold by anyone. And I believe because of that, I've won over a lot of voters on both sides of the aisle.
So let's talk about what's going on in your own party right now, which is a very interesting debate at the presidential primary level about capitalism. And interestingly enough, early in this race, when there were 17 or so candidates running, there was kind of this media framing as if the spectrum was Sanders and Warren on one end, and then sort of this sliding scale to maybe where Joe Biden is as a centrist. Interestingly enough to me, Bernie Sanders is obviously a Democratic socialist. Elizabeth Warren is farther away from Sanders, and Sanders supporters will tell you that, than a lot of people thought early on. She has been a defender of capitalism, albeit a reformed capitalism. And I see that you have had some charitable things to say about Warren lately. Are you someone who wants to see one of the remaining candidates win? Where are you sort of in that process of evaluating the candidates in your own party?
Well, I believe the Democratic Party should let the Democratic process play out, mm-hmm. and we should believe in who our voters pick. That being said, where do I stand? Listen, I'm not going to fight about what a socialist is or what a social democrat is. These definitions, more than that, let's talk about the issues issue by issue. What I believe is that our capitalist system as currently constructed serves the interests of the elite, and it is totally out of whack, and it is exploiting the average American. Now, look, you know my background. I'm a corporate attorney. I'm someone who's worked in business, and I've worked with many corporations over the course of my career. I graduated from law school with a substantial debt, and I went into a field that allowed me to pay that debt. And I saw firsthand, for better or for worse, that the efforts that corporations take to shape the so-called free market to their advantage. There's this idea out there that if we let the free market go, it will solve all our problems. But the free market is based on rules. And those rules are influenced by policymakers, by also by corporations and lobbyists who have the lawyers and the money and the power to shape the rules in their favor, whether that's bankruptcy law or anything else. The problem in America is we have nobody shaping this free market, our capitalist system, to make it fair and so that average people are not exploited. So that's where I stand on capitalism versus socialism.
But are you a capitalist?
Yes. And in the past, when my opponent calls me a socialist, as you know, I've been employed for years by his own family's company to make them millions of dollars. To call me a socialist is ridiculous. The only thing socialist about me is I like social security, and I'm going to try to protect it. Now, does that mean I think that our current version of capitalism is the way we should go? No, it is completely different. When you have, over the last 40 years, the average CEO pay has gone up 1,000%. It's just not a sustainable system where you have all these benefits of new technology or automation and all this new capital, and you see the growth of our country's overall economy over the last 40 years, and the fact that the average buying power of the families in NY27 remains the same or decreased than it was before, and we have the worst job market in the country. It's just not acceptable.
So we'll get back to Delaware North in a moment here. He's referencing the Jacobs family's ownership of Delaware North and your own employment there. I want to get back to that in a moment, but sticking with capitalism here for a moment here, mm-hmm. diagnosing what's wrong. I'm sure you know that younger voters, age 18 to 34, have a very different view of capitalism than older voters. 18 to 34. I mean, it's something like a 50-50 split on favorable, unfavorable. I mean, it's bordering on unfavorable among younger adults. They don't view capitalism as a slam dunk good idea. And I asked a billionaire on this program yesterday. Tom Golisano was on the program yesterday, the founder of Paychex and the philanthropist, big name in Western New York, former owner of the Buffalo Sabres. I asked him why Tom Golisano thinks, and I'd like to listen to this if we could. I asked him why he thinks capitalism is getting a bad name, especially among younger adults. Let's listen.
Well, I can only base this on intuition, but I have the feeling that the guilt lies with our educational system. In talking to my children and my grandchildren about their educations at the secondary school level, it's not like capitalism is extolled as a great virtue, a great economy, a great way to build wealth in the country. It's like it's demeaning.
Do you think it's possible that in the current system, people are legitimately hurting and they're not feeling the kinds of effects or rewards that you would hope capitalism would have?
Well, let's face the reality, Evan. No matter how great your economy is, no matter how much wealth has been created in your country, you have to understand there's always a bell curve of wealth or success. You always have a bell curve, and there's always going to be people at the low end of it. Now, I think the great thing about the United States, the people at the lower end probably have a better lifestyle and living conditions than they do any place else in the world. I'm not sure of that, but I'm guessing that.
That's Tom Golisano yesterday. Nate, what do you think?
It's repulsive. He's basically saying they deserve it and they should be thankful for what they have when this man has wealth he could never spend in 100 lifetimes. Now, the myth here is that a billionaire has worked a billion times harder than the average person. And as the son of a widow that raised seven boys, I can tell you she never made more than probably $30,000 a year. And she worked pretty damn hard. I will say, to your original point about young people frustrated by capitalism, a lot of the young people I meet are angry. And I think we're at risk of losing the benefits of capitalism. Now, you know my background. I lived overseas for a long time. I saw firsthand the devastation caused by Maoism and Stalinism in Asia. And I saw the benefits of capitalism, which are considerable. But when you have a system where average people can work a lifetime and not have what something like my opponent, frankly, earns from a trust for doing nothing but breathing in a year, there's a problem with that. And we have to look at our tax system, our overall, the structure of our economy, and the costs of just living in the society. The cost of rent, the cost of food, the cost of just survival have gone up. But again, the average buying power of the average American has not gone up. And as we see increases in technology, we see increases in just benefits to our overall economy, those benefits are not passed out. Here, there's this myth out there, before we go any further, of trickle-down economics. That is based on so many false assumptions. When money, like we've had this tax cut last year, $1.5 trillion given away to the most elite Americans, there's an assumption that that money is going to trickle back into America. It doesn't. Capital seeks the rate of highest return, whether that's in India or a joint venture in Russia or in South Korea, where I previously was employed, the money trickles out. And that's the big flaw in the trickle-down economics theory. We need the money to bubble up by investing in people who will spend the money immediately, investing in education, in infrastructure. You want to help NY27 recover its infrastructure and recover its economy? You invest in broadband and put good union jobs back to work as they install those lines. 100 years ago in America, everyone listening, go look at the lines that are across this region. We had the guts to say we're going to put telephone wire from end to end. We're going to invest in infrastructure. And that created jobs and that created an economy. Now we're afraid to talk about broadband. We're afraid to talk about new technologies and green energy, which are also good paying jobs. Mr. Golisano does not understand how average families live in NY27. And frankly, neither has the last three representatives in this region, a region that has been marked by corruption and the two special elections in 10 years. So I ask the people listening on April 28th, give somebody a try that's like them, that experienced the same issues they experienced, that started off at community college taking the bus, looking for parking, looking for a way to get there. I understand that, and I will represent the people here, whether they're Republican, Democrat, or Independent.
Just to, one more point on the Golisano comments. He did say he doesn't necessarily think becoming a billionaire is about working harder. He thinks it's about working smarter. And that differentiation matters. And the fact, I asked him about Michael Bloomberg's rise in the polls. And he said, hey, it's good that there are Michael Bloombergs in the world. It's good that there are billionaires because they show the average worker that if you work smart enough, you too can be in that spot.
Listen, at the risk of sounding arrogant, Mr. Golisano, you listened to his interview yesterday, listened to mine today. Ask yourself who sounds smarter. I am no billionaire, and neither are a lot of people in NY27. His arrogance by saying that he's smart, listen, he has had some luck and he has some ingenuity, but he should recognize that he is very blessed. And that blessing, America used to be about sharing in the common good. When John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. That was a battle cry for to build the common good. How can we invest in hospitals and schools and education?
Well, he gives money to hospitals. He says he gives money philanthropically.
According to his own dictates and his own largesse. What we're talking about a society where we are committed. Why do we even have government in the first place, Evan? What's the purpose of government? Why do we do this? Why do we have town villages? Why do we have any form of government? Why did we start from small tribes to city-states to countries? Because we were banding together for the benefit of the group and to protect the weakest among us. Not to say, look, I made the money, I'm smarter than you. I think that should be that comment and that type of commentary should be offensive to anyone who's listening who works every single day and doesn't have close to $1 billion.
Do you want a wealth tax? I mean, Elizabeth Warren has talked about 2 cents on every dollar past $50 million in wealth. There are other proposals for various forms of a wealth tax. You talked earlier this hour about the recent tax cuts that Congress and the White House have passed and signed. Sounds like you would have voted against those, but do you want to see a wealth tax?
We gave a $1.5 trillion giveaway. It was the biggest wealth redistribution in the history of our country in 2018. And we have a GDP growth at the same rate or lower. Excuse me, it's almost a point lower than it was under Jimmy Carter. It didn't work. It was a major failure. That last tax giveaway was a major failure. Do I want a wealth tax? I want a tax system that is more in line with the original purposes of the of income tax in this country. You can look at the historical rates of income tax in this country. They're much lower than they ever were today for the most wealthy Americans. And for a company like Amazon, and it's been said many times, to pay less federal taxes than I pay, zero taxes, that's what they paid. It is the reason we're having problems funding Social Security. It is the reason we're having problems funding Medicare and Medicaid. Now, I'm passionate about this because the paradigm that you're putting forward is socialism versus capitalism. I think that's a false paradigm. We're not talking about going into full socialism or anything like it. We're talking about a fair system where the average American has a chance at the American dream, and we support a reasonable and justified safety net so we do not have the type of blight and extreme poverty in the richest country in the history of the world. I'm talking about fairness. I'm not talking about taking away Mr. Golisano's wealth or all of his wealth. I'm talking about him paying a fair tax in line with what average people in America pay so that we can fund Social Security and our hospitals. Listen, I'm going to go after the hospital thing for a second because I recently went to a hospital in Medina, and I keep talking about it because it was harrowing. I met with the nurses there, and they told me that on an average night, there is sometimes as little as one nurse on duty in the emergency room because of staffing issues and because of the costs involved. So I said, how can you serve anybody? I said, and they said, we can't. We have to call for help. So if someone comes in from a car accident or as a schizophrenic or a gunshot wound or anything like that, imagine the dangers involved with that type of staffing. Because we don't take this seriously in our country, the funding of our hospitals, the funding of our healthcare. And we think we can say to a person like Golisano that can afford the best care available, he deserves it because he worked harder than everybody else and he's smarter.
So when it comes to healthcare, there are a number of proposals on the table in your own party, from Medicare for All to, as Pete Buttigieg says, Medicare for all who want it, to, as Joe Biden says, taking the ACA and improving it, but keeping that foundation the same. Where are you?
I believe that single payer is the way forward. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. We have three different versions of the system. You have the UK, which is completely government run, which is very, very popular, by the way. And if you have friends from the UK, they'll say there's problems, as there's problems with any system. But they're overall it's overall popular. And people in that economy that who in the UK who benefit from that system, usually the politicians running say how they're going to fund it more and take care of it. But that's not what I advocate for. There's the second option, which is something more similar to what they do in Canada, where you still have additional supplemental private insurance, but you have private hospitals and doctors work independently, but there's a single payer that controls prices and manages care so we can control costs. And then you have the United States, which you have price gouging and profiteering. No one knows how much you wouldn't. If you went to a car dealership, you would understand exactly from doing your research how much approximately your car would cost or any other type of service that's provided. If you go to the hospital, the cost will depend on what insurance you have, or there could be a million factors. It's completely out of control. So I support a single payer system. And for those who say it's impossible to do, I say to them, we have in America the most expensive and one of the least efficient healthcare systems in the entire world, and definitely among OECD countries. We have less hospital beds. We have higher costs. We have longer wait times. We have less availability of doctors. We have a failing system. So this concept that we are going to cause great harm to our system, I want to tell people, look at the facts and figures. Our system is already failing.
Nate McMurray is our guest for the hour, the Democrat running for Congress in New York 27. There is a special election on April 28th. His opponent is Republican Chris Jacobs, who is going to be with us, I hope, in the weeks to come. In fact, we've been in touch with their campaign and had some good discussions, and so we're going to have that conversation very soon. Equal time is an important value for us here. Listeners, if you've got questions or comments for the Democrat in this race, Nate McMurray, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Before I move on from healthcare, why not keep the ACA the same? Why not keep that system in place and build on it before going to single payer?
Well, listen, you asked me what I would prefer.
Yeah.
Now, I am open to options when I go to Congress. I will work on solutions. I understand there's no perfect answer. My goal would be to move towards single payer. But I'm not going to trash the ACA like our president has been doing by suing for years to take away your rights, to take away protections on pre-existing conditions. So I'm open to that. I'm open to having discussions about it. I do think Medicare, for those who want it, it's problematic in some ways, because what you're doing is you're pushing all the risk onto the government plan. Because the private sector can deny patients care and push them onto the government plan, which will make the government plan more expensive and possibly insolvent over the long run. But I'm open to options, and I'm open to discussing it with my colleagues in Congress.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been going on with Delaware North, your employer. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do as a vice president of business development for them?
I make them millions of dollars by helping them get contracts all over the country and even the world. And I'm very proud of my work, and I love many of the people there. And if they're listening, I miss you guys. How you doing?
They haven't given you any money to your campaign, I notice.
No, and I am on a leave of absence unpaid, which is certainly a challenge for me and my family, and I can't talk about it more than that. But
Well, let me back up and explain here. Mm-hmm. You ran for Grand Island Supervisor in 2015. You worked for Delaware North. Did you have to take a leave of absence?
No.
2018, you ran for Congress. Did you have to take a leave of absence?
No, and I never had to sacrifice all my pay. So this is a completely new situation.
When were you told you're going to be on an unpaid leave?
Well, I was told previously, but I was not too long ago. But I've been resisting it, and I was told it was not negotiable, and I needed to step away. There's clearly a conflict there, and I will let the listeners make their own conclusions. I'm not happy about it. I think anyone who hears the facts of the situation would be angry, but I'm not going to be shut up. I always say on my T-shirts you see not owned, not afraid, and I'm going to continue to speak what I believe is right. If you look at the reverse, what if I had said I'm not going to run in this race? I'm going to back away. My career and my earning potential is more important. That would have been a lot easier. But people who do those things are called sellouts for a reason. I knew this was the right thing to do. It took some guts, and I am grateful to my family for supporting me. But we're going to win.
But for listeners who are going, well, why are you on unpaid leave then? What's the controversy? The controversy is, as you've explained, this is your opponent's family's company.
Yes? Which is just terribly awkward for a company that I helped.
The guy you're running against, so, his family owns the company.
They own the company.
Your employer.
They do. And to see a company that I helped build have their own family member calling me a socialist, I said, well, what kind of company would hire a socialist to run business development? It's very frustrating, I'm not going to lie. And it's a very unique story, not only here, but for the entire country. I don't think there's ever been a case like this. But I'm trying to do the right thing, and I'll continue to fight for NY27.
But Buffalo News, here's what they had to say about some of your characterizations of this, because you've been writing on social media and trying to hit Chris Jacobs as someone who owns a casino or a sports teams or, you know, fabulously wealthy opponent is sort of how you've described it. Here's what the Buffalo News says in regards to the question, is Nate McMurray's opponent a billionaire? They say essentially no. They write the following, quote, it's inaccurate to say Chris Jacobs owns a casino or a sports team because, as Jacobs said, he has no direct financial connection to Delaware North. Chris Jacobs' grandfather and great uncles started Delaware North in Buffalo more than 100 years ago, and his grandfather passed it down to his children, including Chris's father, Lawrence Jacobs. But Jeremy Jacobs, who has run Delaware North for 50 years, bought out his siblings, including Lawrence, decades ago. Jeremy Jacobs and his sons, Jerry Jr., Lou, and Charlie, oversee the company and the Bruins today, and Forbes estimates that Jeremy Jacobs and his family have a net worth of $4.5 billion. So the Jacobs family, net worth of $4.5 billion. Your opponent, Chris Jacobs, his dad was bought out many years ago, and he's saying, look, that is not my company.
Hold on a second. You don't have to be Columbo to figure this out. I mean, the situation is, I mean, there's things I can't say on the air, first of all, but I'll say what we all know. His grandfather founded this company. They're fundraising for him. They're connected to him in many, many ways. I've said his family owns the company. Now, my uncle, when I grew up, was the richest person I knew. He was an electrician. He owned a Cadillac. His uncle owns two casinos in NY27 and owns the Boston Bruins. I think it's appropriate to say that I am up against considerable wealth. Now, whether he technically owns the company and his title's on the company is certainly helping raise money for his campaign. How many dollars have they given to his campaign?
Thousands, 34,000, something like that.
So far, and how many have they given to my campaign? And that's just
that. Zero.
By the way, that's just through their official means.
That's true. And if I remember correctly, and I don't want to misquote, if I remember from that article because I don't have it in front of me right now, Chris Jacobs said something like, "Hey, you know, their family, they're donating." What he means are employees of that company feel like family to him.
Okay, listen. Why is this an important issue? It's an important issue because no matter how you slice it, this is a man of considerable wealth. Considerable wealth that goes back generations in this country. And this is the third person of considerable wealth that was chosen by elite party bosses in Erie County to fill this seat. The third person in a district where we have had similar people from similar backgrounds repeatedly go through the process of corruption, defamation, and finally resignation to lead to two special elections in 2 years. I'm not saying that he's going to commit the same acts. I'm asking people to look for someone from a different background, someone who may be able to relate more to their conditions and circumstances, especially when you look at my opponent's background himself. He's a former leader or owner of a health insurance company that went bankrupt. He's someone who was the split vote voting against New York State Health Care Act. He's someone who has held positions that are in many ways opposite to the positions I hold, which are about equality and fighting for the working class of NY27.
He's going to come on this program and say, Nate McMurray's attacking me for being successful. That's anti-American.
I'm not attacking for being successful. I think my story is a heck of a lot more American than his. His sounds like something from feudal Europe. If you look at my story, I grew up, started off at community college, took the bus, worked my way up to law school, received a prestigious scholarship, taught myself Chinese, taught myself Korean, came back to Western New York, ran for local office, and now I'm running for Congress. His story was born into great wealth, started some businesses that were not successful, went into politics, and he's been in politics for almost 30 years. Or 20 years at least. So if you think our backgrounds are relevant or important, which I do, and I think my background is relevant and important, I don't criticize him for his wealth. I think his wealth is indicative of some of the policies he's fighting for. And I think if you look at his voting record, you look at the things that he represents, that is the history that he'll bring into Washington.
So you think he's out of touch?
Absolutely.
Well, we'll talk to him when we get a chance about how he feels that he is in touch with the voters.
Go ahead.
But that's going to be a conversation to come here. Can I get a phone call? Let me get Peter in Rochester on the line with Nate McMurray first. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, Evan and Nate.
Hey, how are you?
I wanted to say that I... Good, thanks. I want to say I completely agree with you in regard to your response to what Tom Golisano said yesterday regarding... working smarter. I mean, I think what he's really saying is that if you're not working smarter and you're not as successful as him, then you're inferior. He may not realize he's saying that, but that's really what it means to say you got to work smarter to be successful. That means that everybody in this whole country that's not at his level or even close to his level must be inferior to him. And that's the kind of system that he's working towards. So just want to say I agree that people should be offended by what Tom said. Even if he doesn't realize what he's saying, he really is saying that.
Peter, thank you. Go ahead, Nate.
Peter, I want to say to you, thank you for saying that. And those listening, you know, we're almost trained not to take this stuff and not to be angry about it. I'm telling the listeners, you have to have some type of righteous anger over this type of discussion or this type of abuse almost. You are a stakeholder. Not only in the businesses you work for, but in this country. And to be treated like you're just someone who is a burden or someone who is lesser than because you're, to put it simply, the value of you as an individual does not equate the value of your bank account. And we need to stop and fight against that mentality in this country.
Are you happy to see Michael Bloomberg in the race?
No, I'm not.
You think he would be a good standard bearer for the Democratic Party?
No, I do not. I think that stop and frisk was terribly offensive. I think that he is. I think the fact that he has so much money in this type of oligarchy, it's a challenge to our democracy. There's a reason why we created. There was a time we went through similar in this period in this country. But when they first put in the income tax in this country, there was a period of gilded wealth of robber barons, and they said, "How are we going to? We feel it's a threat to our democracy to have this type of great wealth where you can literally buy the rights to be in these positions and buy control in Congress." So they put together the income tax to try to work against that. The Supreme Court, they challenged the income tax in the Supreme Court. They came back and they said, this is just. And for the next 70 or 80 years, all they did was to try to cut back the income tax to create a system where the wealth were untouchable again. And we're in a situation now where, whether we like it or not, we're facing true threats to our democracy because of massive wealth where people are able to buy positions. That being said, if he's the man on the ballot, he is better than Donald Trump, and I will support him. But I am terribly troubled by some of his previous positions, and I'm terribly troubled by the type of wealth he's throwing around to get this position.
The mayor of Rochester, Lovely Warren, is one of a number of mayors supporting Mayor Bloomberg. Are you surprised by that?
No, she has the right to support whoever she wants to. I am not going to support any of the candidates. Again, if he is endorsed, if he becomes the candidate, I will support him because I think we're in a terribly dangerous time in our country. But I am troubled by the type of wealth he has. I'm troubled by his previous experience, and we'll have to see where it goes.
After our early break of the hour, Matt in Rochester will take your question. He wants to know Nate's thoughts on UBI, a universal basic income. So we'll get Matt on the phone next. And a lot more with Nate McMurray to come. He's the Democrat running for Congress in NY27. He is not afraid to mix it up, if you'll notice, on social media, and occasionally tries to counter what he thinks are misperceptions about gun rights in this country. We'll talk about that and a lot more with him next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about authenticity online. What's real? What's authentic when you post on Facebook, social media, various places? Is that really what your life looks like? Should we care? Do you feel like the version of yourself that you post is the true version of yourself? How do we know? We'll talk about it all next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Nate McMurray, Democrat running for Congress in NY27. The Republican is State Senator Chris Jacobs, who will be on the program in the weeks to come. Matt in Rochester next with Nate McMurray. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, how you doing, Evan? Thanks
Very good.
For taking my call.
Sure.
Nate? I supported you last go-round out in Canandaigua. I did some volunteering.
Thank you, sir.
No problem. I plan on doing it again this go-round. I'd like to hear your thoughts on two things. First, a value-added tax in comparison to a wealth tax. And then second, using a value-added tax to have universal basic income, monthly stipend to citizens.
Sure. Well, the exact details of how we get to UBI, I leave up to our further debate and consideration. But the principle of UBI is something I support. And if you think that sounds crazy, well, there's another man who supported it, and we celebrate a national holiday in his name, Martin Luther King. He was one of the original supporters of UBI. And what is UBI? It's not a giveaway. It's an understanding that we live in a society that's changing, where many jobs that previously existed no longer exist. And the promise of technology and the advancements of the technology is that the wealth created by the technology was supposed to be spread out to more people, so more people can be innovative and create new jobs and new opportunities. What we have now is the wealth that created by new technology or advancements in technology is concentrated. And the other thing we have to talk about and understand is that UBI, we currently have a system of disability in this country that for thousands and thousands of people are on disability, but they are incentivized not to work at all. With UBI, it's a system that is given to everybody that incentivizes them to work, to take risks, to take new opportunities. And I think that's it's something that should be explored. Exactly how it's implemented, I don't know. And because it's such a new concept, I believe we should probably experiment and have test trials to see how it does work and the impacts on it. But I do support working towards UBI for all Americans.
There's a logic there, you think?
Yes. And I also think further, let's think about what the real purpose of government is again. We're trying to make people happy, to have more free time, to have more time with your family, to have more success, to more innovation and technology. We're not just trying to keep the lights on. We're not just trying to make sure that Tom Galisano's mansion is pretty and has good, you know, flowers in front of it. We're trying to spread the wealth to make sure that everyone has prosperity and happiness.
I have another clip I'd like to play. And before I do that, let me read a comment from a listener named Adrian who wrote to us on Twitter to say, "Can't listen live, but I'd love to hear Nate's perspective on having more multilingual members of Congress, especially people who have lived overseas as he has." That made me think of the president's remarks just last night. Now, at a rally, the president was riffing, as he often does. Not sure if you heard these remarks, but he was upset about the Best Picture winner at the Oscars, which was Parasite, of course. Let's listen.
By the way, how bad were the Academy Awards this year? Did you see it? And the winner is a movie from South Korea. What the hell was that all about? We got enough problems with South Korea, with trade. On top of it, they give him the best movie of the year. Was it good? I don't know. You know, I'm looking for, like, where let's get Gone with the Wind. Can we get, like, Gone with the Wind back, please? Sunset Boulevard. So many great movies. The winner is from South Korea. I thought it was best foreign film, right? Best foreign movie. No, it was did this ever happen before?
That's last night. Nate, what do you think?
It's some fascist stuff. I mean, anyone listening to that with good conscience and thinks that makes them proud, I don't know how it could. It's embarrassing. It's offensive. It represents a decline of the United States. To have that type of leader who is so uneducated, so insular in his thinking, it's repulsive. And let's remember to everybody listening that South Korea has been our ally, forged in blood, for 50-plus years. Listen, I've been to the DMZ many times with U.S. and South Korean soldiers who fight like brothers against tyranny. Okay? These are not our enemies. These are people who have been with us on the front lines for decades. There's a word they use, both American generals and leadership, and the South Koreans, they say "kachi kapshida," which means "let's go together." They say that every day on the front lines of the DMZ. And to have our bumbling president talk like that about a movie that was so well done and so well receptive because it's hitting a nerve. Listen, the movie was fantastic, first of all. And it was applauded because our country is noble enough and secure enough to recognize art regardless of where it comes from. And that was what made our country special and noble and great for so many years. He wants us to go back and watch movies from 60, 70 years ago. I mean, that the recognition of Parasite by the Academy in the United States of America represents the true international soft power of the United States, that we're
That was a sign of strength?
It's a sign of strength, absolutely, that we can say to the world, we appreciate your art and we accept it and we will take it and we will learn from it and it will make us stronger as well. There was a lot of insight in that movie. A lot of people in America listened to the message and it resonated with him. And what he was doing is a cheap race play. Let's be honest. He was making fun of it because it was not in English or it wasn't from here. And that's his go-to move. Make fun of outsiders. Split it.
Got a lot of applause at his rally.
A lot of repulsive things get a lot of applause at his rallies. And to your original point, do people cheer that stuff here? Some do. But guess what? More and more people don't. And I will be proud, regardless of the outcome of any of election I'm in, to stand up to racism, to race baiting, to the type of behavior that is propagated by our president. And I think everybody out there has to do the same. Speak out, because he's normalizing things that are not American. The most un-American thing about the things he said about the Parasite were his own words.
Let me get Hal in Dansville real quick on that subject. Go ahead, Hal.
Sure. I very much agree with Nate. I'm from the southeast corner of the 27th district, and I feel very much the same, that that was an outstanding movie, and the issues of economic injustice are so universal. I also feel that the president's removing diplomatic or at least visitor rights from African countries like Nigeria and Tanzania. I lived in Tanzania for years and learned Swahili and grew to know how brilliant many people are if they had access to Sunni education like I did growing up in New York. So thank you, Nate.
All right, Hal, thanks for the phone call.
Yes, thank you, sir. By the way, I love Dansville. I love going there. I love the history. I love the Star Theater. I love the whole thing. So I appreciate the call from Dansville.
So let's talk a little bit about Second Amendment and gun rights. This is a district where there's a lot of interest in this subject. You've had a lot to say. And I'm curious to know, first of all, kind of why don't you lay out your position as where you see policy needing to change first. If you're elected to Congress, what's a reasonable change in gun policy in this country that you would vote for?
There's low-hanging fruit right off the bat. The first two things is we can do universal background checks. I think the large majority of Americans say that needs to be done, universal background checks. It's something we should be able to work right away. It's something the president himself has said. There's things that we can do further, but we have to look at it and figure out how to get there. What I don't want, I go to speak to gun clubs as much as I can. A lot of times they won't let me go speak, even though I'm a lifelong gun owner. The NRA gave me an F rating. I've never had a vote on a gun. The only thing I ever did about guns is when I was a town supervisor, we passed a resolution saying we support the Second Amendment. But that's the only vote I ever had on guns. But I have an F rating from the NRA because they don't even want to have a conversation about why you can't sue gun manufacturers for liability. It's the only company exempt from such a thing. The reality is, and I say the same thing when I go to gun clubs, and they usually agree and bow and shake their head and say that he's right. The status quo is not working. When I have to send my children to a school where on a weekly basis they have to have drills to protect against gun violence, like in the 50s and in the before, we had drills to protect against bomb threats. Now our kids are hiding and pretending that someone's attacking their school. And all our kids go through this. I worry every time I put my child on the bus. I don't want to live in that country. And I'm a gun owner. I say it all the time. I'm an Eagle Scout. I do find it offensive.
What do you own?
I own a Remington 870. It's a shotgun. It's a home protection gun. It's something that millions of Americans have. It's something that would be very lethal in the wrong hands. But I believe in protecting your home. I think it's a principle that many Americans share. Now, some people disagree with me and say that's crazy, but it's something I've kind of was raised with and grew up with. I hope I never have to touch that gun in such a situation. And I understand the statistics say that it probably will not help me anyway. But it's something I grew up with and I like. And I like to go to the range with my friends. And I've done that many times. It's fun. And especially I live and grew up in a quasi-rural setting. I enjoy it. But if we're not able to have an adult conversation about gun violence in this country, then it's never going to get better.
I admit that I get frustrated when we have conversations about gun policy because I think it is a I think there are reasonable ideas on a lot of different directions, and then I think there are some unreasonable ideas. And one of the unreasonable ideas is that any change in policy is a slippery slope to full confiscation. I don't believe that's true. I understand that in a small, some sort of tiny subset of policy thinkers, that might be the sort of Trojan horse goal, but I don't think that's usually the goal. And so when we talk about, for example, a category of weapons that might commonly be referred to as assault rifles. And I know that that is a term that some people don't like. When we talk about possible bans on that kind of weaponry, I'm often told by gun rights advocates that is a slippery slope to full confiscation. I don't know that I think that's a fair argument, but I want to ask you, number one, do you support banning of that category of weapon, and do you think it's a slippery slope?
I do, with exceptions. If someone has a justifiable... Look, to get an AR-15 is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's easier... It's harder to get certain licenses to operate construction equipment than it is to get an AR-15. Any type of dangerous device or material or controlled substance, you have to go through certain procedures. And I believe that gun... We know from statistically that gun is the gun of choice for mass shootings. Thinking about ways to make sure that that gun only goes in the hands of people who are qualified or trained or have a justifiable purpose for the gun makes sense to me. The opposite argument that we need to arm against a potential civil war against the government, I think is ludicrous. Nobody wants to take your guns. I certainly don't. If anyone came to my house and said, I demand your shotgun, I'd say, no way. It's wrong. That's a scare tactic. It would be logistically impossible to seize guns, even if people wanted to. There's millions and millions of guns. But I do think we have to have a reasonable conversation. No other country deals with the type of mass murder that we see by gun violence.
All right, a couple more brief ones before the hour's up with Nate McMurray. By the way, your website is what for people to learn more?
VoteMcMurray.com. You can email us at info@votemcmurray.com. April 28th, give me a shot. Let's see how it goes.
All right. So if someone kills someone with a baseball bat, mm-hmm. I don't think you can sue the Louisville Slugger Company for that. Why should you be able to sue the gun manufacturer?
But you can sue many other companies, including the pharmaceutical companies, for marketing that's inappropriate or over-marketing or selling in unreasonable ways. There's all types of liabilities for different types of products. The fact that you have a singular cutout exemption for a singular cutout exemption for gun manufacturers is for one reason only, because they have a strong lobby that protects them from any type of scrutiny whatsoever. Doesn't mean we want to seize your guns. It means we have a country with the highest gun violence in the entire world, and we need to think about ways to reduce that violence.
All right. Todd says he heard something inconsistent from you in that you don't seem right now to be all the way to the positions that Bernie Sanders is. You don't want Michael Bloomberg in the race, but you said you'd vote for whoever the nominee is. He says there's other people you could vote for. You don't have to vote for someone with a D next to the name.
No, because this is what I was taught. I disagree with you on that one, because I believe that the president is an existential threat to our democracy. I think the things he's doing to normalize white-collar crime, he very well pardoned Chris Collins. If you look at Chris Collins' statement upon sentencing, he was pleading to the president for such a pardon. I am sorry, President.
And he was the first major Republican in Congress to support Trump's run.
Right. And if you get my opponent on here, you need to ask him, because he said not a word about Chris Collins in the past. Ask him if he's against a pardon for Chris Collins, because that would be completely unreasonable to the people of Western New York. I think that we need to understand that President Trump is a real threat. It's my hope that we have a different candidate that's endorsed or comes forward. But I believe sometimes you have to choose between the lesser of two evils.
Teresa's worried that people aren't going to show up for the special election. And so let's just, in our last minute and a half, let's talk about this. It's April 28th. Mm-hmm. In your last run, November of 2018, against Chris Collins, nearly 300,000 people voted in the district. You came within about 1,000 votes. How many people do you expect to show up in April?
Right. We could have counted that election 50 times to get 50 different results. It was heartbreaking for us, but there's going to be far less people coming out April 28th. That's why I need everyone listening to go out and tell your friends to go out. They are going to kill me in billions of dollars of big money ads for the next 2 months. I'm not going to even recognize myself for the next 2 months of dirty and attack ads. We need to counter that with people power. People power beats corporate power. And so I need everyone to get out there April 28th. Before we stop this, I never get to say this. I want to say this to you. If I go to Congress, and I believe we're going to go this time, I will be a fierce supporter of public media. I think I have been enriched as someone who grew up without a lot of money by having free access to NPR and PBS that enriched our family's lives, and I thank you for it.
That does you no good, and that just means that the next time you come on, we're going to have to be ruthless. 30 seconds, though. Why do you think your district so consistently votes big for Republicans?
Because there's a machine out there that is so powerful. When I first went to these Democratic committees, it was like one or two people. It was like a support group more than a real committee. The committees are growing. And shout out to Cindy Appleton in Wyoming County
You don't have time to do the
okay,
whole
okay, okay. Well, I could do them all, but they're really starting to grow those counties. And I think people are starting to choose policies and people over party. We're starting to change. We're starting to say the real division in this country is power versus no power. And so people are starting to try to take their power back.
That's what Molly Ivins, the late columnist, used to say. It's not right, left. It's top and bottom.
Absolutely.
It's up and down. Not left, right.
I agree with that
100%. Nate McMurray, the Democrat running for Congress in NY27, April 28th special election. Look for an interview very soon with his opponent, State Senator Chris Jacobs. Thanks for being here, as always.
Thank you, sir.
More connections coming up. Sir is my dad, by the way.